your source for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Bright the cheeks and warm the heart, for tread the circle thrice about to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. My guest tonight is Terrence Ward, and he's the author of the newly released book, Empty Cauldrons. Now, Terrence is a journalist and a practicing pagan for more than 30 years. He's been bound to a Wiccan coven, has communed with the earth as a backpacking pagan or a Gaiaped. I like that word. He's a member of the Order of the Occult Hand and also a temple priest of Poseidon, and he holds ministerial credentials from the Church of the Sacred Earth, which is a union pagan congregation. Now, his book, Empty Cauldrons, is about navigating depression through magic and ritual, and about looking at a pervasive condition through the eyes of magicians, spirit workers, polytheists, animists, and witches, and his own experience, actually, and also the spiritual methods he uses to cope. Now, chat room questions and comments are welcome for those of you who are listening live here in the chat room, and those of you who aren't here in the chat, you're more than welcome to join us at paraxradionetwork.com. Well, Terrence, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marla. It's really exciting to be here.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Well, you know, I'm going to start out by saying, for someone who confessed in the book that you really didn't want to write this book, why not? And what finally compelled you to give in and go ahead with it?
The reason I didn't want to write this book is basically because depression, by its nature, likes to be hidden. And it hides in different ways in trying to alter our behavior, or we're kind of whispering discouraging words in our head. And when it was proposed to me that this might be a good book to write, I said, ooh, gosh, I can imagine that if I really dive into what depression is like, it might bring up some feelings and perhaps put me at risk of experiencing more depression. And that didn't sound like fun, but as someone who has seen the other side of depression and knows that this is something that is not the end of the world, I realized that it really is important to try to collect some of the wisdom we have in our pagan communities about what to do with this really difficult condition.
Well, I also like the title, Empty Cauldrons. Now, where did that come from?
That was straight from spirit. I honestly wasn't expecting to have to come up with a title. I'm a little bit naive about writing books, and they said, oh, but what do you want to call it? And I panicked, and I froze, and I said, Empty Cauldrons. And that was a couple of years ago, and the more I sit with it, the more I realize it's exactly what this book is about, because there is a hollowed out feeling. There is an emptiness that you can feel when you're deep in depression, and it feels like there's nothing left for you to give. And that's not necessarily true, but I think it very much captures the spiritual state that we can be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love it when we get inspired by, or for lack of a better word, from spirit, because it comes out of your mouth and then you sit there for a minute and go, ooh, that's good. It must not have been me that thought that up. You know, give spirit all credit. But I think that's really neat. All right. So here, an important question, and somebody asked me to ask you this before we got started, but you probably have heard it 100 times. Every one of us gets depressed sometimes, but that kind of depression isn't necessarily the same as a chronic depression in clinical terms. How can people distinguish one from the other?
What really is the difference is whether or not you get stuck in that place. I compare depression and grief in my book. Grief is something that can feel absolutely crippling and paralyzing when you're overwhelmed with this sadness and loss, but you understand what caused it, and you are usually capable of processing those emotions, and over time, it's not going to consume you. With depression, it's harder to pinpoint the target. What's causing this? And that's something that we desperately want to know as humans, is what caused me to feel this way? And with depression, it's 1,000 cuts that makes us vulnerable. And you usually can never really pinpoint where it came from. And you're often unaware that it's even going on. And that helps put you into a cycle of it not being able to heal. And that's really what stands apart, is that you're having an experience that isn't changing. You're not moving forward. You're not progressing and finding a way to get better. And that's a signal from spirit or mind or even body that there's something wrong and you're stuck and you probably need some help in order to get somewhere.
Does everybody get that epiphany, or can they live for years and years without even realizing it?
Oh yeah, that happened to me. I probably spent a good 15 or more years in depression without understanding it. That's what it was, until somebody told me. Somebody with professional training said, "I think that what's going on is that you're suffering from depression." And even though I knew that people suffered from depression, it didn't occur to me that it was me.
Yeah, it's kind of a sneaky thing then. And
yeah, where's the helmet of invisibility?
Or the cloak, yeah. I mean, one of the two, yeah. It's got to be very difficult. But I know you've spoke with pagan clergy, depression sufferers, therapists, and several people from our magical world that names are familiar to me and some of our listeners, about their personal experiences with depression. And you seem to have covered all bases. So let's talk about how the book incorporates depression with magic and ritual.
Oh yeah, that's an essential part. I see depression as being something that affects us spiritually and physically and mentally. We definitely have symptoms in all those ways, and it can be treated in all those ways. It's important to recognize that you really can't treat just one of those three and get much progress, and that includes spiritually or magically. But I think that that's an area that is very neglected, and since that's something that we're mostly open to in our communities, it's really a way that we can address it. Now, the title talks about magic and ritual, and I do have some of each. And some of the magic that I have is simple stuff like candle spells. I offer a candle spell to help draw off a negative mood, to help you see some light. Kelvin Mercury, who was one of the people I spoke with and is an author as well, offered me a spell for finding a therapist, because if you're a pagan or a witch, you might be concerned that your beliefs are going to be misinterpreted as some sort of mental breakdown. And whether or not that's true, it's important for you to feel like you're going to be in a safe space with someone who has that discernment.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of other spells I offer have to do with mirrors, because our self-image can be really, really twisted when it comes to being in depression. We see the worst in ourselves, and that's all we see in a lot of cases. One of them is a simple spell to help you remember the beauty in yourself, and another one takes on grooming as part of its aspects, because one of the things that we sometimes do when we alter our behavior when we're in depression and we have less energy is we might actually reduce our physical care for ourselves. And this spell helps incorporate that back in. And, well, whether you're doing it magically or not, sometimes taking a shower makes you feel better. Mm-hmm. And incorporating magic into it can't be a bad thing.
No, incorporating magic into a lot of things is never a bad thing. We just have to try teach that to the mundane world rather than have them, you know, run away or point fingers. Now, you know, you're a journalist and you have many exercises in the books, as you said, and spells. And the first one in the chapter on spirits is a journal exercise where you introduce yourself by writing a Dear Depression letter. Now, that in itself is very clever. Is writing the letter a way for the person to acknowledge that the depression is an entity in of itself? Because you write that depression is a spirit and that one can relate to spirit.
Yes, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool animist, and I very much feel that it's easier to engage with something if you see it as a separate being with agency. And that journal entry about a journal exercise about writing a letter is one of the ways that you can think about it that way and find a way to engage with it. Another one that I present in the book is a little bit more complex and it can be challenging perhaps if you're deep in depression, but I suggest creating a physical totem for your depression and inviting it to move into it. And you can give it offerings, you can treat it with respect, you can try to give it what it needs without giving it yourself. And if you can pay attention to that, it can help you understand in a physical way what your relationship with depression is right now.
Well, okay, so you're saying that like depression is a spirit, and now you're talking about a totem that you could put the depression in there. Is that almost like depression could be a thought form of some sort?
Yeah, it could be. I think I was careful in the book not to declare that it is absolutely something from outside of us or right. Something that was created within. Either way, it's something that has a voice in our head, which is not necessarily our own and doesn't necessarily feel like it has our best interests at heart.
Okay, well, you just said that, and that popped into my head now. When depression gets into your head as a thing, a thought form or something, can't a spirit guide or a guardian angel or somebody that we have in our heads anyway, you know, helping us out, do they help to kind of keep that depression, or can they help to keep that depression either at a decent level, if there is such a thing, or get rid of it completely?
If you have a relationship with one or more spirits, including gods, they absolutely can help you during this period, but you often will find that you can't easily sense those spirits. I think if in the hardest parts of depression, we kind of shut ourselves off from that, and it reinforces the idea that we're alone and unwanted. We might end up feeling like our spirit guides have abandoned us, which isn't probably true, but it can feel like that. Just like your human friends might be all around you and still loving and caring about you, but you might feel like they've abandoned you despite the fact that they clearly have not.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, timing is everything, but I popped on YouTube today and they had a thing about Naomi Judd, And her daughter was talking about it today because she said they finally found out how and whatever. And she, that was one of the things that she was saying, that she was hoping that her mother could wait another couple of days because she was going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, the Song Hall of Fame, or one of them. And she said the depression in her was so bad that she couldn't accept all the love and everything, the accolades, and that she was worthy of getting that award. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we're talking about it, and it sometimes when you talk about something or plan for something, it all comes back to you in different ways. And this is, you know, what it happened today. And it was really interesting. But you just also said, because depression includes isolation and a mental state that impacts, like you said, how people experience things and also the divine. And as you said in the book, at times it can make people think that their gods have turned their back on them or the goddesses. Why is it important for depression sufferers to interact constantly or continue to interact with their god or goddesses, gods?
I very much support the idea of a routine, a regular ritual or practice, whether that means for you meditation or lighting a candle that to invoke certain spirits or some spell work or prayers and offerings. It's very, very helpful to have a regular practice, especially if you feel through your experience that you are susceptible to depression, because depression can return for some people. It's not always a one and done. When you have a regular practice, even though you might feel like you're shouting into the void, you're still being heard. And it gives you something of a lifeline to just cling to that routine. Okay, this is something I can do without engaging my conscious mind, which might be sapped due to depression. But if I have the regular routine, other parts of me can take over and go through those motions and maintain that relationship. Our gods lift us up. Our gods support us. Our spirit guides do what they can to support us. And even if we are blind and deaf to their presence, it's important to maintain those relationships because they are real.
So we can, if we're in a really funky depression, we can still kind of listen to the voice in our heads or the feelings and kind of try to work your way through certain things, like to keep going with that thing every day or whatever.
Absolutely. One of the more challenging suggestions I have in the book is that community is a benefit that helps dilute and dispel depression. The problem with this is that depression, by its nature, alters our behavior to make us want to shy away from people. It can make it downright revolting to be able to spend time with people. And that I find that the things we don't want to do are the things that will do the most to help us with our depression. That's why we're being steered that way. In the case of regular ritual, it might involve helping people coming in and helping you with that work, or participating and getting you to show up for full moon rituals and driving you if necessary, and making sure that you do participate in community even if you're not feeling it. And that involves communication with people so that we can assess each other's moods and states of mind and help us be open and honest with when we're going through a dark time. That's the sort of cultural shift that we might need, that like Kari Turing, who spoke to me about some of the Northern European traditions, talked about how people are more open about their emotional state, and they're more prone to support each other as a community when they're going through tough times.
Yeah, I mean, like attracts like, and I think it is difficult sometimes. And I mean, just sometimes I just want to get introverted and don't, you know, leave me alone, and sometimes not. So yeah, I think it's important to try to get into community and with people that experience the same thing that they're going through, because as you said, you know, you feel isolated, you feel like you're the only one, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what makes it bad. The chapter on depression and the gods is really interesting, and it has a whole selection on deities who might have a particular interest in or understanding of depression, like Apollo, Freya, Hecate, and the Morrigan, and there were a few others too. And in case the reader doesn't know which god to interact, there's an exercise called Find Your Gods. And whether they're listed in the book or where they're found elsewhere, can you explain what it takes to do that exercise to find their gods?
I certainly can. In fact, I'm going to just flip to that page because, believe it or not, I don't have this book memorized.
You're not the only one. I don't think any of us that have books have. Well, no, there are that, people.
That's something I actually kind of thought happened when you wrote a book, is that you knew every word of it inside and out.
No.
Silly me.
No, true you. Because I have to grab my books too, and a lot of guests do, although there are a couple that kind of blow my mind. That you could ask them anything, and they've written 100 books, right? You can ask them anything about the most littlest thing in a book that you wouldn't even get, and they know what you're talking about. More power
no
to them.
No question.
So, yeah.
Anyway, you said you wanted to talk about Find Your Gods, and I
yes.
am just trying to find the page. I know I marked that page specifically for this podcast. I promise you I did.
Well, I believe you, and I'll be looking too, but I'll tell you if I find it. But in the meantime, I mean, how important it is to keep in touch with them? Or maybe here's a better question. What if you've never been in touch with them? And, you know, you don't know the first thing about, I mean, some people might get scared about it. It's on 111, I think, is where it started.
Yes, chapter. I just found it.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, there are people that work with their gods, but there are people that have never worked with their gods, and it might be very beneficial if they did know how.
Yes. And that's actually something that was a struggle for me for many years, to find the gods that really connected with me. I had relationships with different gods over the years, but none of them seemed to be my forever god, if you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean.
Sure.
And I, for me, it was kind of a surprise when I found out that Poseidon was going to be the one. Wasn't high on my list. That's why I didn't realize it.
Love it.
But the trick is with finding your gods is that you need to start with the stories of gods. A lot of us in the United States are most familiar with Greco-Roman gods, and that doesn't always resonate with everyone because it might not fit who they think they are, for
right.
whether it's cultural or some of the style of some of the myths which can be troubling, or for any other reason. But those are a good place to start, because once you start looking into mythology, you can start opening yourself to learning about stories. You might find stuff on the internet about gods. You might hear from people at pagan gatherings or in other places, and just kind of be open to it. And from that, you can make a list of the gods that just kind of perk up your ears and maybe even your that create that tingling that makes you say, huh, this is something deeper than just a name that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go through several iterations of that process of finding names that you feel might belong on that list, and digging into it and opening yourself to research. And then you should sit with those names to see which ones rise as possible gods that you really want to find more about. And what I recommend is using divination, which generally involves using someone else doing divination, to help you narrow down which gods might be interested in getting to know you better from that list. And from there, you can start to build a relationship by just using that sort of discernment through divination or perhaps another group discernment practice to help you find the ones that you're connected to that might feel right for you as well. Because there are gods that might be interested in you that you want to say no thank you to. And that's okay too. You don't have to say yes to any god.
No, and this could also, if for people that are listening that aren't pagan but religious, you could probably do the same exercise for the saints, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I started out as a Roman Catholic, and it was my first polytheist religion.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's kind of a thing for one and the other. Yeah. Okay. So the other thing, before we go to break, we've got like 4 minutes. I want to talk about meditation and keeping journals, because they're prominent through the book. To meditate and to keep, well, there's a whole bunch of different kind of journal things. How important is it for those two things in regards to dealing with depression?
I think that each of them has tremendous value. I already sort of touched on how journaling can allow you to create a conversation, a dialogue mm-hmm. with depression, which helps you see it as something that is not you, which is very empowering. Mm-hmm. Journaling also has in combination in common with meditation the opportunity of attuning yourself with different layers of your own consciousness and understanding how you're feeling and what wisdom you have within yourself. Being still and quiet in meditation can be incredibly difficult when you're depressed. There have been times when I wasn't comfortable closing my eyes just because it would be worse. Mm-hmm. And for that, I recommend micro meditation. Can you do a minute sitting by yourself? Well, that's a victory. Do that. If that's all you can do, it's not going to be the most benefit, but it will help get you into that routine. And maybe when you're ready, you can add 30 seconds or a minute, whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. Journaling is in some ways less intimidating than meditation, because you aren't necessarily having all of your dark thoughts welling up. You can have more control because your pen, and I do recommend if it's possible, you do this by hand, because your pen is a wand. And that can help you focus your energy and focus your intent and attune yourself to your different selves and help understand who they all are in this conversation.
Wow. I've never thought about the pen as being a wand. This is good. There's another thing that people are always asking me about when it comes to meditation. They say they can't meditate. They can't do that. Everything is can't. What do you tell people who say they can't meditate?
I suggest you sit. And when that thought comes up, say to yourself, wait. And then wait. And if that thought comes up again, say wait again. And say wait at least 3 times, because you just want to put off that thought that you can't meditate. And lo and behold, after 3 times of waiting, you might find that you've meditated.
And if not, you do it again, 3 more times at another time, right?
Exactly. There's no judgment. You can go back to it when you're ready.
Some people are very stubborn in their mind, you know. The blinders are on. No, I tried it once and it didn't work. And the same thing with divination. I've tried, you know, the divining rods. I've tried scrying. I can't do it, you know. And can't, I think, is the worst word that anybody can use, because the only thing that's probably holding you back is yourself. Yeah?
And many, many human endeavors become easier with practice.
Mm-hmm. And I think patience comes into that too, because, you know, I mean, I'm bad at certain things and I get really impatient and I just, you know, and I walk away and it's like, oh, I'm stupid, I can't get that. And sometimes they don't try again, you know, because it was so frustrating the first time. So
now,
I think
what I just heard there wasn't just impatience. I heard, oh, I'm stupid, which is a voice in your head saying horrible things about you,
well, that's
which
true.
Might actually make it harder to be patient.
I say that, but I realize that I'm not. So that part's okay. But, you know, sometimes you feel like, you know, whatever. Okay. On that happy note, we're going to take a break for a couple of minutes. So everybody stay with us and we'll be right back.
Don't go away. There's more Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks right after these important messages. Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witch's Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com.
I was in the hospital with my son for 18 months.
When he got injured, I wasn't prepared, but I knew I had to be strong.
When I was told about John's injury, I was in complete shock. I just remember rushing into his room and giving him a big hug and letting him know I was there.
These veterans and families are just a few of the heroes we serve at Homes for Our Troops. For thousands of severely injured veterans, everyday life is filled with barriers.
It was really the little things throughout the house. Counters that you can't roll up to.
I had to drag my wheelchair down steps.
I want to help, but he is so determined.
At Homes for Our Troops, we build specially adapted custom homes with features like wheelchair access, roll-in showers, and automatic door openers that allow them to function independently and focus on their recovery and family.
This house is freedom.
It's hope. It's a new beginning.
This house has given me my family back.
To learn more, visit hfotusa.org.
New Aeon Now. News and discussion of the metaphysical, the occult, the paranormal, and much, much more. With your hosts, New Aeon High Priestess Reverend Lily Alley, head of the Draco Chapter of the Order of Paranormal Exploration, Christine Matza. The New Aeon is now. Join us every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for New Aeon Now.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Myself. Okay. welcome back. My guest tonight is Terrence Ward, and we're delving into his new book, Empty Cauldrons, Navigating Depression Through Magic and Ritual. And right before the break, we had a question coming in from the chat room, so we'll get to that right now and then get back to what we were doing. The question is, how to know what culture of gods to relate to? She says, I ask because I personally relate to the Celtic god of Dagda.
It can be especially challenging now to figure that out, because in addition to the dimensions of what god you might be in relationship with, there's views by other people, and other people might have opinions about what gods each of us can and should be in relationship with based on the problematic history we've had with one culture oppressing another and appropriating another. It's really, really important to use divination, I think, in these cases, because that's how we can best communicate with these corporate beings like gods. If you aren't in an opportunity where you're like in a ritual where a particular deity is ritually possessing someone and you can speak from one human to another, divination is your most reliable source of information. And it's better if someone else is performing the divination, because it is really hard to interpret readings that you give for yourself.
Okay. Now, we've talked about meditation and journaling, again, some of the gods, and I think the next thing we need to touch upon is shadow work, because that sounds very, very interesting.
Yeah, I've had people say that the pandemic has been an unexpected invitation to delve into shadow work. The shadow work is something that mostly dates back to Carl Jung, and understanding that we will put things into our shadow self that we really don't want to deal with, but that doesn't make them go away. And shadow work is deeply complex, and I barely touch upon it in my book, but it's really just essentially acknowledging the dark things in ourselves, what we see as flaws, what we see as our mistakes, recognizing that they're part of who we are, and loving ourselves, finding ways to love ourselves regardless of what is in our past and what we see as our essential character, because we are beings of light, and the shadow really just distorts how we see ourselves.
Okay, because I've heard of a lot of people talking about shadow work of late. It's kind of, I don't want to say it's trending, but I think more people are learning about it and hearing about it. And I know someone said to me, well, shadow work, is that, oh my God, that's about shadow people, isn't it? No, it isn't, but you're close. You know, so yeah, it's that's very difficult to do, I think, in the beginning, or it sounds at least difficult to do. But, you know, you've talked about it in the book, and it's a good reason for people to get the book if they're really, really curious. And we're not dangling carrots, but I've got a lot of stuff more to ask. So I'm going to move on. All right. Now, there's a chapter on prayers, offerings, dreams, and spells. In other words, they're called pods. And I think that most people pray. I mean, sometimes we get what we pray for, and sometimes the gods or the universe or whoever we pray to decides that it's not a very good idea for one reason or another. And when we pray for something really hard, for something we really want or need badly, we think, and our prayers aren't answered, that might contribute to depression. So is there a way to understand, maybe when we're talking about prayers, that prayers might not come through for a good reason and accept it without making someone feel bad or that they're not worthy of the prayers to be answered?
Well, I'm not even sure that it's always true that your prayers aren't being answered. Sometimes gods understand the big picture in a way that we cannot, and they might understand the deeper import of what we're asking for and provide us with an opportunity we aren't expecting. That's seems to be completely unrelated. We also have to consider the fact that it's when you're in a period of depression, you have blinders on. You're not going to notice signs. You're actually going to forget nice things that have happened to you. Your memory gets distorted to the point where you might not remember being happy or having good things happen to you, and you're more likely to retain the bad memories. That kind of filtering is going to make it very hard to see when the gods are working in our favor. Yes, we should pray. I know that some people really don't think prayer is a good idea, and that's fine. As I mentioned in my book, there's some old school Wiccans out there who feel prayer is akin to begging. And they won't do it. And that is perfectly okay. But if you are not morally repulsed by simply asking and saying, hey, this is beyond me, I could use your help, then there's really no harm in doing it.
Yeah, and that's the truth. I mean, there was a difference between prayers and spells. That somebody said prayers, you're begging, and spells, you're asking for help. So, I mean, but that goes both ways. If you're praying, you don't say, well, do this for me. If you say, you know, please guide me, help me, show me the way, you know, then that's not begging. But yeah, I mean, everybody has their own thought process about that. I think prayer is important, but whatever. That's me. Let's talk about the other pods, though. Let's talk about, start again with offerings. You know, how important are offerings, and what do we have to offer, and to who?
That is, offerings, I think, are just as important as prayers. They actually kind of help complete the circle, because offerings are, when the way it's often been explained to me is, if we look at the relationships we have with other humans, if we like someone, we might just do nice things for them. We might give them a little gift. We might do them a favor. You fold their laundry, whatever. We'll just do nice things that might make them happy and not expect anything in return. In general, that will build our relationship, and that person is more likely to do kind things for us as well. That's really the idea around offerings. I think in most of the polytheist and pagan religions I'm familiar with, that you're not buying a service by giving an offering. What you're doing is you're just building a relationship of good feelings. If you really think this god is swell, show it by leaving flowers on the altar from time to time, or even a cup of water. Water is a wonderful and sacred offering that I don't think anyone refuses. I don't have any experience of anyone saying water is a bad offering. I guess tobacco isn't cheap anymore, but that's a fairly common offering in some traditions. We can offer just simple things like a plant from our garden, dirt that, or a special rock that drew our attention. If you give it to your gods with an open heart and sincerity, it's generally going to be accepted.
Kind of like it's the thought that counts, right?
Pretty much.
All right. I like that. All right. So now I'm going to jump into dreams, because I've never thought about gods showing up in my dreams. And I don't know that I ever have had that happen. But they do come through, don't they? So how would we recognize it if that was to be the case? I mean, it's hard enough to remember dreams anyway, but I would think it would be something that we might wake up and remember and realize that it wasn't quite that dream about, you know, flying or something, that it was something substantial.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Dream incubation goes back at least to ancient Greece, where it was used for attuning with ancestors and gaining insights into healing in certain particular temples. Gods can speak to us through dreams, and I imagine that there are times that they send us dreams that we don't remember because it's not their wish. But we can't deal with that. We have to focus on dreams we can remember. How do we determine if a dream is a message from a god or just a jumble of neurons firing that's releasing energy in the night? Well, I'm again going to suggest that divination is a good way to go. If you get a reinforcing message from divination that supports what you got in your dream, then you probably were getting a message from a god. It's more likely if you already have a relationship with a god, but sometimes that's the way they can get your attention. It's entirely possible that you just had a really cool dream and it was particularly vivid, and that's actually pretty entertaining if it wasn't a disturbing one. But I would say divination is the best tool. And again, divination from someone else is easier to trust. And even getting a second reading isn't a bad idea, because that's group discernment is a valid way of practicing any spiritual path.
And I know a lot of people do divination, and there's a thousand ways to do to divine things. Some people use pendulums, some people use scrying, some people use crystal balls, whatever. And it would be okay. I mean, if you don't have somebody that will be there with you, what do you think is the best form of divination? Bibliomancy, something like that. I mean, you know, something that people haven't done it before and just need a little help.
Yeah, I think that simple and straightforward is harder to misinterpret. Something that's got a lot of layers of nuance, like tarot, is going to be. You're going to see exactly what horrible things you want to see if you're reading for yourself.
Yes.
I like using three coins and asking simple yes or no questions with all three heads being an absolute yes and all three tails being an absolute no, and the other two combinations being versions of maybe, edging one way or the other. Bibliomancy is also pretty effective, especially, you know, it depends on the book, I think. I haven't tried it with a lot of books. Maybe I should try it with my own book to see how it works out.
Yes, you should.
Once I get a hardcover, I'll do that. I think it'll be easier. Pendulum is also pretty good because it has a lot of black and white and direct answers. I use a form of knuckle bones divination that has very set meanings based on various ancient Greek texts that are pretty unambiguous. You just want to avoid things that are super sophisticated, I think, because the parts of your brain that can see that are just going to twist it into whatever the depression wants you to see.
So what do you do with the coins? You like shake them up and drop them on the table like I Ching or something, or
just flip them one at a time. I can do that. I have some heavier coins I do that with. They're that are easier with pennies. I would probably just toss some three in the air and be mindful where you're landing them, because I've had coins roll into all sorts of awkward places.
There you go. Yep. Okay, so it's like it's like a crapshoot, but it's not in, I mean, just physically in the sense that, but yeah, I agree. If you have a definite yes or no, you can't read into it. And cards, as you said, and I would never read for myself, and it's hard to read for friends sometimes because that's, you know, gets a little weird. All right, well, let's get to the last pod, which is spells. Now, we've been often told not to attempt to do spells when we're under the weather, both physically or mentally. But you said that spells do work if you suffer from depression, but you describe it as something akin to flying blind. And you have a quote from Ivo Dominguez saying that depression and magic can coincide. So how do you feel about if you're not up to par to do spells or magic?
I was especially struck by how Ivo described the experience, because what I really got from that interview is that depression and magic can coincide if you are a practiced magic worker, if you know what you're doing, and it kind of enters that muscle memory type of exercise. You can definitely work with magic because your ability to gather will isn't dependent on your conscious mind any longer. It can be really challenging, though. Courtney Weber is pretty sure that maybe a house caught fire because of a spell she was asked to do while in depression. It's harder to calibrate what you're doing. It's like if your feet fall asleep and you're trying to walk around the house, you intellectually know where the floor is, but you're not going to be tiptoeing because you your senses are just all off kilter. It can be a real challenge, and what Ivo also said is that he found it was much easier when he was doing work for other people, when there was some love and caring involved. Mm-hmm. I think that depends on the individual, but it does actually show an outlet, a way forward to remind you that this is something that is part of your power and you can lay claim to it.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, we learn from our training wheel cauldrons that if you don't believe in the spell that you're doing, if you think there's the slightest doubt, it's not going to work. And so I would be thinking that somebody that is depressed and not sure of themselves anyway would have a difficulty maybe doing a successful spell.
What I think I hear from the people I talk to is that, yes, that's true, unless you have 10 or 20 years of doing it under your belt, then you might do it. Then the belief is no longer a barrier, because magic isn't actually powered by belief, but it can be blocked by a lack of belief up to a certain point. Once you're an evolved enough caster, that's not going to be the issue.
Okay. And you've got, speaking of spells, some wonderful spells in the book, like Binding Depression, Breaking the Curse of Depression, Protection Against Depression, and a few more. Now, binding spells, you know, again, early on, you're taught never to use binding spells unless they're absolutely necessary, because they can boomerang back on you and do harm if you don't do it right. But I really, on the other hand, think that having the ability to do a binding spell with your depression would be a wonderful ally.
Yeah, it can be quite empowering to find a way to just kind of still that part that's within yourself. The reason why I introduced both binding and protection into this is because, yeah, I do have some ideas about the nature of depression, but other people have different ideas, and I wanted to explore the fact that we can approach this magically differently depending on how we conceive of depression. Binding is a really good thing if you think depression is something that is part of you that needs to be kind of tamped down. Protection might be better if you see it as an external force that's trying to invade your space.
Mm-hmm. Can people also work with elementals as opposed to spirit?
Yeah. I didn't delve into that as deeply in the book. I've explored some of that in some blog posts I've written since then. But depression has a lot of elemental qualities, and it can make most. It can really bring out the worst aspects of different elements, and finding using purification and cleansing that's focused on one element or another can really help clear that out. Like I think of fire as a good example, because fire in its most destructive phase is a lot like the explosive anger that you can sometimes experience with depression, which comes from that same kind of blindness that the magic problem happens, because you are often not as connected to your emotions. And if you can conceive of fire more as a single flame on a candle that you can use to focus yourself, it's going to be a much more helpful metaphor for working with that energy in yourself.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, also I'm thinking about binding, but also like kind of warding that people can do, anybody can do that. And again, there's a lot of people that aren't pagan listening in, but all of these tips are very useful for both religious and spirituality. Something as simple as a white light, you know, surround yourself with the white light. And some people do that in prayer. Some people do it as, you know, just something to protect them. What do you think about the white light?
I very much like the idea of warding, because one of the challenges with depression is how it can sneak up on someone. You might not realize you're depressed for days or weeks or months after it begins, and having a white light or other warding system to help alert you to that is really helpful, because it can help you be aware and find ways to alter your behavior and increase your community contact, maybe even engage more with a therapist if you have one, and just help you take control of the situation before it gets out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we could go on and on for like another hour, but the clock isn't cooperating with us. So before we have to say goodnight, let people know what your website is, what they can find there, and maybe what people can find at the Pagan Way Station.
Oh, sure. My website, because my name is often misspelled, is not my name. It is truepaganwarrior.com. And there you find some information about this book and others that I've had published on my own, as well as an ongoing blog about different topics around paganism and my views on the world, as many blogs are. And the Pagan Way Station is my Etsy store, which I link to from my website. It's mostly a variety of curious and interesting objects I've acquired, but I am developing more products of my own, such as the soaking stones that I talk about in one section of the book, which is incorporated into a bath spell that I'm going to be offering in the near future for people who don't want to hunt down stones on their own with instructions. And I hope to expand my offerings as I think about what people are interested in most about what I've written.
Yes, they will be. We've given them a taste of it, and there's a lot more to it, so yes. I want to thank you for sharing Empty Cauldrons with us. It's informative, it's interesting, it's helpful, in many, many ways. So thank you for taking the time to be here.
And I really appreciate the opportunity. This has been a joy.
Well, someone in the chat room just said, please have him come back. So we might do that.
We'll consider it. Thank you.
Okay. I want to thank everybody else for listening in as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2024. The Mysterioso March by Kevin MacLeod is licensed through Incompetech.com.